Hello, and welcome to A Taste of the Past on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, and today we are sponsored by Hearst Farms, and very happy that they have our sponsor today. Quite fitting, too, because today I've chosen to talk about charcuterie, or in other words, I want to get the skinny on bacon. And charcuterie is actually, I guess the reason I chose it is because America has this newfound fascination with bacon, artisanal bacons, and cured meats, and things that Europeans have for so long taken for granted, and actually kind of cuts of meats and products that were popular at one time and then fell out of popularity and now are finding a newfound audience, particularly homemade ones. And I have with me a charcutier, Gabriel Ross. Gabe Ross is the chef and charcutier, difficult for me to say, which means he's the one who makes all the charcuterie, the cooked and cured meats, at Dixon's Farm Stand Meats in Chelsea Market in New York City. And happened to know Gabe well, walked in to my kitchen, and he was rolling pancetta. Another time, he was stuffing sausage casings. So I know the guy really does make cured and smoked meats, and now he's got his own smoker. And welcome, Gabe.
Thanks, Linda. It's good to be here.
In fact, you have quite a smoker, but we're going to get to smokers later. Right before the show, we were talking about differences between American, French, Italian. I mean, charcuterie really comes from the French, meaning cooked meat.
Exactly.
You know, but then it took on, and it was primarily pork.
Primarily.
Yeah. And now it's come to take on a different meaning, which is cured, basically just cured meats. I mean, it's a way in history that was, it was very important, right? It was a way for them to keep meat.
Absolutely. In a time when there was no refrigeration and most of the animal was heavily salted, the bits and pieces, the scraps that couldn't be turned into, say, a salami or something along those lines, or a ham, would be quickly ground up, mixed with whatever was on hand, and then cooked. Traditionally in France, it was cooked in a pastry shell, which was the only
casing
vessel available, and placed in the bread oven, usually after the bread had been baked and cooked that way. And that way it was contained, it was portable, and the pastry wasn't actually intended to be eaten. It was just the meat inside.
It was a very crude lard pastry,
like a salt dough.
Yeah, salt dough, right?
Yeah.
Then it took on much, much more elegant forms. And so from France, talking about the cooked charcuterie first, we have the rillettes and the pâtés and the terrines.
Mm-hmm.
But what is, I think, really interesting that's happening more, that we find a real movement in is the cured meats, charcuterie, the bacon, the guanciale. Well, no, that's Italian though. But mm-hmm. the bacons and the hams and goodness, not smoked but cured, and then let's talk about the difference between salumi in Italian is really charcuterie, and people often think salumi is just sort of a weird way of saying salami. It's not. Salumi are the cured meats,
right?
Right, and that's what is that? That's the prosciutto and.
Well, the word salumi comes from the Latin word for salt, so it means anything salted, which was the only way to preserve fresh meat for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
It was standard procedure when you butchered a hog to immediately put as much as you could on salt to preserve it. Fresh pork, up until the advent of mechanical refrigeration, fresh pork was very, very rare. So in that sense, the charcuterie of the Mediterranean region was based on salt, whereas further north it was based on both salt and cooking or smoking. It all comes down to climate, really.
Hmm.
The fancy stuff that we associate with France was largely a product of the cities and the north, where the climate didn't lend itself to making a whole lot of dry cured sausages, air cured products. So you'd find a lot of cooked charcuterie, also still heavily salted. I mean, the traditional methods for making, say, duck confit, for instance, which we're all pretty familiar with from restaurants, involved salting the meat, the duck legs, or the goose legs, if it's goose confit, salting them very, very heavily.
Before cooking it, immersing them in all that oil or fat. Hmm. Interesting. But and these methods have been around for, I mean, as you pointed out, for centuries. I mean, than centuries.
Yeah, we've been eating pigs for a few thousand years now.
Yeah, and I'm in sausage. I mean, sausages, that's a whole other ballgame, and that goes back even further, probably. As far as from like Chinese, it's 600 BC. They say they found evidence of the written and other evidence of fermented sausages, dried sausages, smoked sausages.
Yeah, absolutely. Those preparations have been around probably as long as people have been trying to hold on to their food. I mean, there's no incentive to preserve the meat if there's an abundance of fresh meat, but in some places there isn't, and I'm sure people quickly discovered that both salt and fire were useful in extending the life of their food supply.
And their lives as well.
Exactly. So
that was the primary reason. So what made you get interested in making, I mean, this is a time consuming, labor intensive process.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
What made you, just an obsessive desire to eat good food, or?
Well, I was a professional cook for many years.
I'm sorry. Yes, and I forgot to say, Gabe is a former chef, a restaurant chef. But I did say you are a chef. You're a chef in the farm stand. But
I like to think that I'm retired.
Uh-huh.
This is my.
You're a little young for that. All right, but I interrupted
you. So, well, in restaurants. Really, in the United States, you only see this kind of French charcuterie in restaurants. There are products available in specialty food shops, and more so in the last 10 years than ever before.
So that, how did you get into it? To make it yourself? I mean,
well,
especially like the pen. Not the cooked rillettes and things. I mean, that I understand. That's a fun. That's a real cooking chef's kind of thing. But the cured meats.
I'm not sure I've ever met a cook who didn't have a desire deep down inside to just put salt on a big chunk of meat and let it sit around for a few weeks.
See what happens.
Yeah, exactly. Partly because the end result is so delicious. We, as cooks, are exposed to a lot of these products and gravitate towards things that are especially satisfying. Now, the first time I tried a slice of salami in Italy, I felt like I had been lied to my entire life, because it was such an exceptional product and such a much more complicated and it had so many subtleties that the products, the salami I'd had in this country didn't have. But at the same time, I understood, you know, that it was compelling because I had always loved this stuff.
But being the light went off and then there was these tender chunks of fat
and the
silky taste of pork.
The layers of, you know, acidity and saltiness and the complex flavors that develop with aging. These are all things that make these products especially appealing. It's very much like cheese.
Mm-hmm. But in speaking about that, very much like cheese, what do you look for? What tastes do you look for when you're really making an analysis or discerning a good quality sausage from a bad quality, or ham, let's say, different. I mean, I know from different types of prosciutto, but what do you look for? What is it we're looking for?
First,
or we should look for?
You're looking for the taste of the meat. First and foremost, it's a meat product. If the person that made this product started with good quality meat, you should be able to taste it. It should taste like good meat. Beyond that, the next thing you're likely to taste is salt, because that's the second ingredient in all of these preparations. Meat, then salt. Beyond that, there may be some sweetness. Frequently in the better products, you'll find some acidity that's either part of the meat flavor or as a result of a fermentation process. Mm. With aging, you get nuttiness. You'll find hints of even a fruitiness to it. Depending on the amount of fat that's present, you may get buttery flavors. Overall, though, it should taste like... It should be to meat what whiskey is to beer, a distillation of the raw material and a transcendent expression of, you know, what the animal is to us.
So we're really getting this essence of meat. Well, let's get back to, you said it all has to start with good quality meat. And we were primarily talking about pork, mm-hmm. pork sausages, bacon, mm-hmm. Pancetta, now guanciale being from the jowls or the cheeks. Let's talk about the pork. If you start with a bad piece of pork, you're going to get a bad ham. I mean,
yeah. People who cure meat, I mean, the meat packers and the artisans all over the world know this almost intuitively. There's no way to make a good cured product out of bad pork, and so the manuals that I've seen from the 1930s, the 20s and 30s, and all of the texts from the French charcuterie schools, they all start with selecting your meat. That's the first step in the process, and the guidelines for selecting your meat, you know, aside from it should be fresh and it shouldn't be, you know, stinky or off color or any of those things, that's obvious. But you're looking for a meat with a good texture. You're looking for meat that's doesn't have a real high moisture content. You're looking for meat that's got good color. And then even beyond that, certain breeds, with pigs specifically, there are breeds that have been developed specifically for curing. The most famous is probably the Blackfoot pigs of Spain. They're
the Iberico ham for the
exactly. I mean, these pigs are descended from stock that was developed by the Basques back in the Middle Ages, and these the Basques dealt in mostly in hams and salt cod. Hmm. They had a thing for salt, and they had a thing for curing, and they developed a breed of pig that was specifically designed for curing. You rarely ever see fresh meat from these animals because they're so, they have the right ratio of fat to lean. They have high quality fat. And then they take to the salt very, very well.
So that has a lot to do with diet, I'm sure, and their ability to root in free range. Mm-hmm. In fact, I mean, in America, we didn't see a lot of this lately, good quality. Things like salamis and prosciuttos we bred the fat out of the pork.
Oh yeah, it's been an obsession over the last 50 years in the United States to lean the pigs down to the point where they were almost indistinguishable from chicken.
You got it, tasteless. They said the other white meat. Well, indeed it is. You know, it white and tasteless, and it nothing like a fatty pig.
There was a time in this country when the lard on the pig was more valuable than the meat.
That's right. Pork was raised for its fat. Yeah. Right.
They would take the meat and literally toss it to the side. As they were harvesting the fat from these animals, because the lard was used for everything from making lamp oil to lubricants to cooking oil, everything. I mean, lard was paramount, and the pigs that they raised for this purpose would be unrecognizable to us today. I mean, they had very little musculature and huge amounts of fat.
Hmm.
But over the last 50 years, we've seen the breeders working towards, and this also corresponds to the rise in popularity of fresh pork as a product, you know, something that people will eat every day, something that people expect to have on hand. And so the pigs became more muscle and less fat. And then when the diet trends went in the direction
our diet trends, not the pigs, right?
Yeah, when our diet trends went in the direction of, you know, no fat, you know, under any circumstances, they discovered that they could breed most of the fat right out of these animals. And so you get these pigs that look like bodybuilders. They have no appreciable fat. Their meat is extremely lean. Unfortunately, it makes for terrible charcuterie.
Well, and then the commodity pork, the large breeders and processors throughout America, a lot of the practices were unsavory and not good for the land as well and the environment. So that has been changing over the several years, right?
Right.
And we are seeing some new breeds, some small farm breeds coming about.
Absolutely. The resurgence of heritage breeds, while challenging for farmers and for retailers, is a great thing, because it like the resurgence of heritage or heirloom vegetable varieties, it gives us a little bit more to play with. The genetic palette is a lot more diverse, and if a farmer needs a pig that does well outside on pasture, but at the same time, you know, is a long, good bacon hog, he can choose from a couple of different breeds to develop his stock. Whereas up until maybe 15, 20 years ago in this country, farmers were kind of at the mercy of the breeders in terms of lean and mean. That's all they got. These pigs that were designed for super lean meat and to be grown in confinement.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, you said a buzzword, bacon. Long, long bacon hog. I want to know more about bacon when we come back.
Munching down on that
yummy, yummy, yummy. I love bacon, yes I do. Matter of fact, bacon is my favorite food group too. I love bacon, yes I do. Matter of fact, bacon is my favorite food group.
I love bacon too, and we are here with Gabe Ross. Gabriel is the chef and charcutier at Dixon's Farm Stand Meats. An interesting article was written in the Art of Eating last year about your charcuterie, both the cooked, well, some of the sausage was mentioned, but mostly your cooked charcuterie. Mm-hmm. And just recently, last week, there was a very nice piece about, in New York Magazine, about your an accidental reintroduction of a pastrami style meat, a rolled beef.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the rolled beef first, because I just mentioned the article and everyone's curious now. What's rolled beef?
Well, up until probably 2 months ago, when I read David Sachs's book Save the Deli, I had no idea what rolled beef was. I had never heard of this product. Not because I'm not paying attention, but because it had essentially disappeared from the American food culture and from New York delis, the cradle of this product. It's basically a pastrami that's designed to be sliced cold, like a cold cut, and used for sandwiches, like a cold cut. Typically, pastrami, as we know it here in New York-style delis and in Jewish delis around the world is served hot, preferably sliced by hand, although more frequently now on a meat slicer, and it's a flat cut.
Mm-hmm.
It's
with a nice layer of fat and fat and flat, right?
Exactly. And so the pastrami's that we know are most traditionally made from a cut, a beef cut called the navel, which is analogous to the belly on a pork, on a pig. You will see a lot of pastrami made with brisket, which is connected to the navel, although considered a separate cut. And occasionally when you go to a deli, you know, a corner deli, you'll see pastrami that's round. It's made from a part of the hind leg of the cow. And that's generally considered to be an inferior product. And that's, so I won't talk about that. So the navel pastrami, navel actually was a cut I had never heard of, before I started at Dixon's Farm Stand. And I was introduced to the cut. And at the time I didn't even really grasp that it was the traditional cut for pastrami. I thought pastrami was made from brisket. Which is understandable because a lot of places are making their pastrami from brisket. It's a much more readily available cut. We had a surplus of navels on hand at the store, and I was trying to work out a pastrami recipe. I'd experimented with pastrami from the round, as I said before, an inferior product. I couldn't make it as good as I'd like. I'd experimented with brisket, and I found it to be good, but not quite what I was looking for, especially since I was looking to make a product that we could serve, that we could slice out of the cold case.
Mm-hmm.
We're not doing hot pastrami sandwiches. You know, we're not set up like Katz's where we can, you know, slice by hand. So I thought I would try and tweak it to develop a pastrami that did well on the slicer as a cold cut. And our meat cutter, Adam, introduced me to the rolled beef navel, which is a retail cut that we put in the case. You take the navel, which is kind of long and sort of rectangular and fairly thin, and you roll it up. Looks like almost like a pancetta.
Well, that's what I thought. It looked like a cured, smoked, steamed pancetta, and mm-hmm. yet it's beef, so you know, it makes it all good.
Well, the funny thing is, when I first started thinking about pastrami, this was a few years ago, after having a superlative sandwich at Kenny and Zook's in Portland, Oregon, I'd never really thought about pastrami seriously. It was just a, you know, deli meat,
right.
And I had this sandwich, and it just literally blew my mind. And I thought to myself, this is how you get beef to taste like bacon. Which maybe takes some explaining. A lot of people don't know that pastrami is a cured and smoked product. It's similar to a corned beef in that it's a piece of beef that's been brine cured, or sometimes very rarely dry cured, and then rubbed with spices and smoked, which I think accounts for a lot of its appeal. It's just there's something primal about that cured and smoked
flavor.
Yeah,
well, there's a lot of it's got a depth of flavor. There's a lot of layers of flavor, or layering of flavors there.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful. Well, I think, you know, I was thinking about the fact that you serve this rolled and cold and, you know, rolled mm-hmm. up and cured, and then cold sliced, and you serve it in your sandwiches, like mm-hmm. and that's, but people just know they're eating pastrami in a sandwich. They don't know that, think they're eating rolled beef, rolled navel, because it's the same thing. And then what we're traditionally used to eating the hot pastrami, as you pointed out. I wonder if because the hot pastrami, the fat seemed a little more acceptable to us, you know, it was more translucent, a little, you know, or less trans, I mean, more almost transparent. It was, mm-hmm. And you could pick it apart if you wanted to, but on the rolled navel, you really see that layer of fat, and that fat has the flavor.
Oh yeah.
But, you know, people, and once again, we get back to this in their diet, they're turned off to eating the fat, not realizing that was the flavorful part. I don't know. But you mentioned that that it making something taste more like bacon. We're back to the buzzword, bacon.
Okay, it's unavoidable.
I love it. Who doesn't love bacon, right? Even dogs, right? And well, in pastrami-izing, I looked up the word pastrami because I was curious about it. And as far as I could tell, it comes from maybe a Romanian or Turkish word, pastirma or basturma, from press, like pressed meats. And pressing meats was a way of curing too, right? I mean, they would press it under lard and then put lard over it or something.
My understanding for the Romanian roots of this product, the meat was, it was beef, and it was salted and pressed to get as much moisture out as possible, and then rubbed with spices and smoked.
Smoked.
And okay. You can actually still buy this stuff. Last time I saw it, I think I was at Calustian's on Lexington, and upstairs in one of the cold cases, they've got some imported, I think it's Turkish, but same idea, the basturma, which is looks like a cross between pastrami and brisaula.
So it is dry. It's got a dry, very dry yeah. finish to it. Well, and David Burke made quite a bit. The chef David Burke kind of launched, and other people had been doing it at delis, but he did his pastramiized salmon. So it was salmon pastrami. Well, you have done something interesting, and you made lamb pastrami. Correct? That was interesting.
Yeah, interesting and delicious. The inspiration for that was a restaurant in Brooklyn called Char Number 4, where the chef does a lamb pastrami salad. And I had no idea how he did it, but I thought it sounded like a good idea, and the salad was delicious. So we, once again, faced with a surplus of lamb bellies. And this sort of led into the eventual development of the rolled pastrami or the rolled beef that we have in the case now. We took the lamb bellies, we cured them, I rubbed them with spices, we rolled them up into something that looked very much like a pancetta, although much, much smaller, and smoked them. And it was very tasty, and while unusual, I think accessible. People seem to respond really well because that cured and smoked flavor is universal.
Yeah, and the curiosity to get that. All right, for those uninitiated listeners, can you give us a crash course in, meaning quick because our that clock keeps ticking, difference between bacon and prosciutto? And of course, not all bacon is equal, as we well know. So then we'll go on to talk about the inequalities or the quality bacon. But the main difference between bacon and prosciutto.
Do you mean pancetta?
I mean pancetta. Yeah, sorry.
It's all right.
Pancetta.
Well, I'll start with bacon basics. A lot of people aren't even aware of where the bacon comes from on the animal. Bacon is...
Maybe they don't want to know. But, okay.
It's pork belly. I mean, we've gotten to the point in this country where pork belly is on so many restaurant menus. We've all had it. We all sort of know.
Wait a minute. Isn't that a Wall Street term, too?
Yeah. And I could go into the origins of that with pork barrels and curing, but we'll say that for another show.
Okay.
So pork belly. You take a pork belly. Now, it's also interesting that a lot of people don't realize that bacon is cured and smoked. I've talked to customers who thought that bacon was just a raw meat, that it was cut right from the pig, tasting just like that. And they wanted to know why that part of the pig tasted so good. So you take a pork belly and you cure it. Now, curing is a word that is tossed around, but isn't generally, people don't really know what it means. In its most basic sense, curing just means rubbing it down with salt and letting it sit for a little while, letting that salt penetrate. The FDA defines curing as the use of salt in combination with a curing agent, which is either sodium nitrite or sodium nitrate. Other curing agents like the ammonium salts of nitrate, those are no longer used.
Thank goodness.
Saltpeter, which is... potassium nitrate is also no longer used. We're pretty much sticking to sodium nitrate and sodium nitrite, and mostly nitrite now because it's faster. So You take salt, you take a little bit of this sodium nitrite, and you rub it on the meat, and you let it sit, and a very complicated set of chemical reactions take place. Mostly what we care about is the flavor and the color. So the nitrite, when the meat is cooked or heated up to about 140 to 160 degrees Fahrenheit, turns it bright pink. It's that ham color. It's that hot dog color. Mm-hmm. It's the color of...
Same smoking meat color you get when you on your barbecue when you smoke something. Right.
So you get that characteristic color, which is very appealing because, as I've learned in retail, nobody wants to buy gray meat. It just doesn't look as good. And you get this characteristic cured flavor. Now, in excess, the curing salts, the nitrites and nitrates will make everything taste like hot dogs. But used in moderation, you get that slightly hammy, bacony flavor that's just very, very, very tasty. And then the last step is smoking for bacon. And that's a process that just gives some, you hang it in a smokehouse, traditionally for several weeks, at a temperature well below 50 degrees.
Real low smoke.
Yeah, that's the old way. The new way is a little different. It's faster. It's a little warmer. But you just put some smoke on that cured meat, and then it's ready to go. At that point, you can eat it raw if you like, although it's much better fried up crispy.
Mm.
Pancetta. Is an unsmoked pork belly that's been cured usually without even, well, in this country, nitrites are used, but traditionally in Italy, they don't. They just salt it and then use it much the way that that Americans used to use salt pork. It's mostly for cooking. It's mostly for cutting up and you fry it up
crispy. It does. It just gives that just that different flavor. I've watched you rolling your pancetta, and you really get a real tight roll on that, and then put it in that twine netting or the string. About how much moisture does it lose during the salting process?
That depends a lot on the ratio of lean to fat. The more fat there is, the less moisture there is to lose. The more lean there is, the more, you know, meat has a lot of water in it, whereas fat doesn't. So I prefer a much fatter belly for pancetta and for bacon, which means that you don't lose very much in the process, in the drying process, in the salting process. But
is it a faster process? It's a faster process too, pancetta? How long does it have to cure?
It depends. The salt curing itself really, for a nice fat belly, only takes about 2 weeks.
So you can really process, you know.
And then you can cook with it. It's
well, as
go.
Much as, I mean, I use it a lot to cook with. And yeah. I know you do too. So you have to process a lot of it just to keep us in business, right? And especially the restaurants. Do you find that more restaurants, to your knowledge, or people coming maybe into the shop, are using more homemade, more artisanal-made products in their cooking?
Well, I have a skewed view because everything we sell is artisanal, is handmade. Our customers are...
Talking to other chefs. Then.
But talking to other chefs. Certainly in restaurants, I know a lot of cooks that are making their own pancetta just because they have a little more control. There are great products available. I mean, there are producers that are turning out a beautiful pancetta.
Carlo, the chef here at Roberta's, where we record here at Roberta's Pizza in Brooklyn, and Carlo and his father do some all their own cured meats and doing some really fine.
Yeah, once you figure out how easy it is to do something like that,
don't tell anyone. You got to keep yourself in demand, right? Well, my congratulations to you for all the wonderful articles that have been written about your product, and we didn't even get a chance to talk too much about the cooked products, but I can attest to the fact that the articles were not wrong. Your rillettes, your cooked rillettes and terrines and pâtés are wonderful. But of course, bacon is always the first love. And I thank you so much. Anyone who happens to be in the New York City area, you can try some of these products at Dixon's Farm Stand Meats. Just ask for their charcuterie. And I thank Gabriel Ross for being my guest today. And you have been listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palaccio. Thank you.